Welcome back to the deep dive. We're plunging into another fascinating topic today, looking for those surprising bits of knowledge that just make you rethink things.
Absolutely.
And today, it's something really fundamental, something we probably all think we learned back in school, our senses.
Right. Sight, smell, touch, the usual suspects.
Or maybe not so usual, because we're diving into some really incredible lectures by Dr. Ty C.M. Hoffman today.
Ah, yes. His work really turns things on their head.
Exactly. Our mission here is to use his insights to uncover the, well, the real story about our senses. It turns out our bodies are way more complex, more amazing than we might think.
It's true. You start looking into how senses actually work based on what Dr. Hoffman lays out, and, well, it challenges your whole view of reality.
Okay, so let's jump right in. The first big thing Dr. Hoffman says is that this idea of humans having just five senses, it's basically wrong. He says we've sort of been lied to.
Yeah, that's a strong way to put it, but it gets the point across. The key thing he explains is the difference between general senses and special senses.
General and special.
Okay, yeah.
What does that mean?
So general senses are the ones that are, you know, spread out all over the body. They don't have one specific complex organ tied to them.
Like touch.
Exactly like touch. That's his prime example.
Show.
You feel touch all over your skin, right? There's no single touch organ. So touch is actually a general sense.
Huh. I never thought of it that way. What else counts as general?
Well, he includes things like feeling vibration, temperature, even itchiness. They're all perceived across wider areas of the body, not in one specialized spot.
Okay, that makes sense. So if touch is general, what are the special five senses, according to Dr. Hoffman? The ones that fit that localized, complex organ definition.
Right. The true five special senses are the ones mostly in your head, with those really intricate organs. So you've got taste gustation with the taste buds.
Yeah.
Sight vision, obviously, the eyeballs. Smell olfaction using the nose. Hearing audition in the ear. And the fifth one, which is crucial but often forgotten.
Balance.
Balance, yeah.
Right.
Also handled by the ear.
Wow. So the ear does double duty. Hearing and balance. That's pretty cool.
It really is.
Let's maybe start with vision then. Dr. Hoffman spends a lot of time on the eye, and it sounds incredibly complex. What about the stuff around the eyeball first?
Good idea. Yeah, he points out that the eye is more than just the ball itself, like eyebrows. We think they just keep sweat out, right?
Pretty much.
But he stresses they're also huge signaling devices. Think about how much you can say just by raising an eyebrow.
Huh, true. And eyelashes.
Eyelashes or cilia, they grow from the eyelids, the palpebrae, and yeah, they're mostly about keeping dirt and stuff out. The eyelids themselves, upper and lower, meet at the corners, the canthus.
And tears. We're always making tears, not just when we're upset.
Constantly. The lacrimal gland is always producing a little bit of tear fluid. It washes the eye, keeps it clean, and it even has antimicrobial stuff in it.
Fights off germs.
Exactly. And he explains why your nose runs when you cry a lot. The gland just makes so many tears that the normal drain system in the corner of your eye gets overwhelmed, and the extra just spills over into your nasal cavity.
Ah, so that's a connection. Okay. And there's that thin, clear layer over the front.
That's the conjunctiva. It covers the very front, the cornea, and the inside of the eyelids. And if that gets inflamed, that's conjunctivitis, pink eye.
Right. Okay, moving inwards. The eye muscles seem pretty amazing, too. We can move our eyes all around, unlike some animals.
Yeah, birds, for instance, often have to move their whole head because their eyes are more fixed. We have six extrinsic eye muscles for each eyeball.
Six.
Yeah. Four are rectus muscles. They pull straight up, down, left, right. And two are oblique muscles. They run diagonally and let us sort of rotate the eyeball slightly. Gives us incredible range of motion without moving our heads.
Amazing. Okay, so you've got the outside covered. Let's get into the eyeball itself. What's the absolute front part, the clear bit?
That's the cornea, the transparent bulge right at the front. Dr. Hoffman points out how amazing it is that living tissue can be that clear.
Yeah, it really is.
It's continuous with the sclera, which is the tough white part of the eye. He notes the sclera makes the eyeball surprisingly hard to puncture.
And the cornea does the focusing, or most of it.
Most of it, yeah. Especially for us living in air. When light goes from air into the watery environment of the cornea, that big change in density bends the light a lot. That's refraction.
Yeah.
It does the main focusing job.
Okay, so the air to eye transition is key. Then behind that is the iris, the colored part.
Exactly. The iris is basically a muscular ring, and it controls the size of the pupil.
Right.
And he makes it clear the pupil isn't the structure. It's just the hole in the middle of the iris.
Right.
So the iris adjusts that hole to let more or less light in. You know, like when you go into a bright room and your pupils shrink right down.
Yeah, instantly.
Yeah.
And the lens, what does that do if the cornea does most of the focusing?
The lens handles the fine focusing. It can actually change its shape, its thickness, to adjust the focus precisely, like for looking at something up close versus far away.
Oh.
Which, as he notes, is different from fish. Their lenses move forwards or backwards, more like a camera.
Interesting comparison. And he mentioned cataracts.
Yeah, just that it's a natural thing that happens with age where the lens can get cloudy.
Got it. What about inside the eyeball, the fluids?
Right. There are two main chambers. Between the cornea and the lens is the anterior chamber filled with a watery fluid called aqueous humor.
Aqueous, like water.
Yep. And then the bigger space behind the lens, the posterior chamber, is filled with a more jelly-like substance called vitreous humor.
Vitreous, like glass.
Exactly. It means glassy because it's clear, though it's definitely not solid. He stresses its job is really important. It presses gently outwards, keeping the retina pushed flat against the back wall of the eye.
And too much pressure there is bad.
That's glaucoma, yeah. If the pressure gets too high, it can damage the optic nerve.
Okay, so that brings us to the retina, the light-sensitive part at the very back, the film in the camera, sort of.
Pretty much. That's where the photoreceptors are, the rods and the cones.
Rods for dim light, cones for color.
You got it. Rods are super sensitive, great for seeing in the dark, but only in shades of gray. Cones need more light, but they give us color vision. There are three types, red, green, and blue sensitive.
Now, didn't Dr. Hoffman say something really weird about how the retina is set up, like it's backwards?
Yes. One of his most mind-bending points. The light actually has to pass through layers of other nerve cells, bipolar cells, ganglion cells, before it even reaches the rods and cones at the very back.
That sounds inefficient.
It seems like it. But, you know, evolution works with what it has. It's kind of amazing it works so well. The signals then go back forward through those layers to the ganglion cells whose axons form the optic nerve.
And that leads to the blind spot, right, where the nerve leaves the eye.
Exactly. The optic disc. There's zero photoreceptors there because it's just axons heading out. So technically there's a hole in our vision.
But we don't see a hole.
Nope. And Dr. Hoffman encourages people to try the simple blind spot tests. It's amazing how your brain just fills it in perfectly. You never notice it's missing.
The brain is amazing. How do we get sharp vision versus seeing faint things? You mentioned rods and cones.
Right. That comes down to the macula and the fovea centralis. The macula is an area on the retina with lots of rods around the edge. But the very center, the fovea, is packed almost exclusively with cones.
So when you look straight at something,
you're aiming the light right onto the fovea. That gives you your sharpest, highest resolution color vision, like for reading.
Okay.
But if you want to see a really faint star at night, Dr. Hoffman says you should look slightly away from it.
To use the rods.
Exactly. That puts the dim light onto the rod-rich part of the macula. Mm. And since rods are way more sensitive to low light, the star will actually appear brighter or sharper.
I have heard that trick. It works. Now, about night vision. Nocturnal animals see better in the dark. Why?
Well, part of it is our retina has a dark, pigmented layer behind the rods and cones. It absorbs any stray light that gets through, preventing reflections that could blur our vision. Keeps things sharp.
Nope.
Nocturnal animals, though, like the cows in dissections he mentions, often have a structure called the tapetum lucidum instead. It's reflective.
It bounces light back.
Yeah. It reflects light back through the rods and cones, giving them a second chance to catch the photons. Doubles their sensitivity in low light. That's why their eyes seem to shine when light hits them in the dark. It's the tapetum reflecting.
Fascinating. So it's all about maximizing the light you have. And speaking of light itself, he touched on the physics of it, the electromagnetic spectrum.
He did. Just a quick reminder that light is electromagnetic energy traveling in waves. The length of the wavelength determines the color we perceive.
And visible light is just a tiny part of it all.
Tiny, like 400 to 700 nanometers is what we can see. But the spectrum goes way beyond that. Radio waves, microwaves, infrared, ultraviolet, X-rays, it's all the same kind of energy, just different wavelengths. We just don't have the receptors for most of it.
So when we see green, like on a plant, the green isn't in the plant.
That's his point. Exactly. The plant's chlorophyll absorbs red and blue light and reflects the green wavelengths. Our cones detect that reflected green light, and our brain interprets that signal as the sensation of green. Greenness is in our head, created by our brain, based on the light waves.
Wow. Okay. That's a lot to take in just about vision.
It really is an incredible system.
Let's switch gears to the ear then. We know it does hearing and balance. How does Dr. Hoffman break down the ear's structure?
He uses the classic three parts. There's the outer ear, that's the fleshy part you see, the pinna or auricle, which funnels sound into the ear canal, the external acoustic meatus, that ends at the eardrum, the tympanic membrane.
Okay, the part we can mostly see, then the middle ear.
Right, behind the eardrum. It's an air-filled space, and this is where you find the tiniest bones in your body. The malleus, enchecus, and spates. Hammer, anvil, and stirrup.
The famous little bones.
Yep. And they connect the eardrum to the inner ear. The inner ear is the really deep part, totally encased in bone. It has the cochlea, which looks like a snail shell, that's for hearing. And then the vestibule and the semicircular canals, those are for balance.
So how do we actually hear? How do those tiny bones work? Dr. Hoffman mentioned mechanoreceptors, things that need to be physically bent.
Exactly. The hair cells inside the cochlea are mechanoreceptors. They need to be physically deformed to send a signal. Sound waves hitting the eardrum make it vibrate.
Okay.
Now here's the clever bit Dr. Hoffman explains. The eardrum is relatively large. The stapes bone pushes on a tiny little window into the cochlea called the oval window, which is much, much smaller.
Like pushing on a thumbtack versus your whole hand.
Perfect analogy. Mm. Same force, much smaller area means much higher pressure. He calculates the pressure gets amplified about 20 times.
20 times.
Yeah. And that increased pressure is strong enough to make waves in the fluid inside the cochlea. And it's those waves that physically bend the little hair cells.
That is ingenious. Wow. How do we tell different pitches apart then? High notes versus low notes?
That's down to the cochlea shape and a structure inside called the basilar membrane. It's like the floor of the cochlea. And it's flexible, but it's wider at one end and narrower at the other.
Like a piano strings?
Sort of. Dr. Hoffman uses that analogy, or like a swing set. A specific frequency of sound will cause only one specific part of that basilar membrane to vibrate strongly, to resonate.
Ah, so high frequencies vibrate one spot, low frequencies another.
Precisely. And because only the hair cells in that specific spot get bent vigorously, the brain knows exactly what pitch it's hearing based on which nerves are firing.
Clever. And he mentioned hearing loss with age.
Yeah, typically the nerves connected to the part of the membrane that responds to the highest frequencies, the narrowest part, tend to degrade first. That's common age-related hearing loss.
Makes sense. Okay, so that's hearing. What about the other job? Balance. How does the inner ear keep us upright? He mentioned static and dynamic.
Right. Two systems working together. Static balance is handled by the vestibule part. It tells your brain about your head's position relative to gravity when you're still or when you, say, tilt your head and hold it there. There are little crystals in a gel that slide and bend hair cells.
Okay, for holding steady, what about dynamic balance? For movement?
That's the job of the three semicircular canals. They're oriented in three different planes, like at right angles to each other. Think X, Y, and Z axes.
Covering all directions of movement.
Exactly. They're filled with fluid. When you move your head nod, shake, tilt, the fluid swirls around inside the canals. This pushes on a little jelly-like structure called a cupula, which bends hair cells.
And tells the brain how your head is rotating.
Yep. Sends signals about angular momentum, basically. Mm. And Dr. Hoffman points out that when you spin around and get dizzy, it's because the fluid keeps swirling for a bit, even after you stop, sending conflicting signals to your brain.
Ah, the spinning kid phenomenon. Got it. Okay, moving on from the ear, let's tackle the chemical senses. Smell and taste, Dr. Hoffman groups them, right?
He does, yeah, because they both use chemoreceptors.
Yeah.
Receptors that detect specific chemicals.
So smell first. Olfaction, where does that happen?
In a special patch of tissue high up in your nasal cavity, the olfactory epithelium, there are receptor proteins on tiny hair-like structures there.
And chemicals in the air bind to them.
Odorants, yeah. When an odorant molecule binds to the right receptor, it triggers a signal, opens ion channels, creates an action potential that travels along the olfactory nerves straight up to the brain.
Through the skull?
Yep, through tiny holes in a part of the ethmoid bone called the cribriform plate. He calls it sieve-like.
And we can smell thousands of things. With how many receptors?
That's the amazing part he highlights. Humans only have about 50 different types of olfactory receptors. But the way the brain interprets combinations of signals from these receptors allows us to distinguish, yeah, thousands, maybe tens of thousands of different smells. It's combinatorial.
Incredible. Okay, then taste. Gustation. Also chemoreceptors.
Also chemoreceptors, yes.
Yes.
Mostly on the tongue. Inside little bumps called papillae, which house the taste buds. Some are in the cheeks, too.
And Dr. Hoffman says the old four basic tastes idea is wrong.
Totally wrong. He makes big point of this. There are five basic tastes we know for sure. Sweet, salty, sour, bitter. And the fifth one.
Umami.
Umami. The savory taste. It responds to glutamate like an MSG. He notes it was only scientifically recognized relatively recently compared to the others.
So no specific zones on the tongue for sweet or sour.
Nope. That's another myth he busts. While you might have slightly higher concentrations of certain receptors in some areas, you can actually detect all five tastes pretty much all over your tongue.
Good to know. And taste and smell are linked.
Hugely linked. Dr. Hoffman really emphasizes this. What we commonly call taste or flavor is very often a combination of true taste from the tongue and smell from odorants going up the back of the throat into the nasal cavity.
Ah, that's why food tastes so bland when you have a cold.
Exactly. Your sense of smell is blocked or reduced, so you lose a massive part of the flavor experience. Pinching your nose does the same thing.
Makes perfect sense. And saliva is important, too.
Crucial. It dissolves the chemicals in food, the tastants, so they can actually reach and bind to the receptors in the taste buds.
And not everyone tastes things the same way?
Right. He mentions the classic example of PTC, a bitter compound. Due to genetics, some people can taste it very strongly, others can't taste it at all. Shows there's individual variation.
Wow. This whole journey through the senses, guided by Dr. Hoffman's lectures, it's been pretty eye-opening, or maybe ear-opening, nose-opening.
Huh. All of the above, yeah. It really has. We started thinking maybe five senses, pretty simple. Mm. But looking at it through his lens, the real number, the general versus special, the insane complexity of vision, how the ear amplifies sound and keeps us balanced, the chemistry of smell and taste, it's just staggering.
It makes you appreciate how incredibly intricate our bodies are, things we take completely for granted.
Absolutely. Even a single sense is this masterpiece of biological engineering, often working in ways we'd never expect, like that backwards retina.
So maybe a final thought for everyone listening, building on all this. If Dr. Hoffman showed us we were mistaken about something as basic as how many senses we have, and if our brain does so much behind the scenes, like filling in the blind spot or literally creating the sensation of color from wavelengths.
Yeah, where do you draw the line?
Exactly. How much of what we perceive as reality is actually just out there? And how much is this incredible, complex construction happening inside our own heads based on the signals these amazing systems feed us?
It makes you wonder, doesn't it? What other obvious truths about ourselves might not be so simple after all?
Definitely something to think about.